to kick off today's session. Today's speaker is Tom Schuller. He is the director of the Watershed Research and Practice Center of Watershed Protection in Maryland. Tom directs the center's watershed research and practice programs and has a keen interest in the science and management of urban streams and lakes. He has worked for more than 20 years on developing innovative techniques to protect and restore urban streams and lakes. He's authored several widely used references, including the Small Watershed Restoration Manual Series, The Practice of Watershed Protection, Rapid Watershed Planning Handbook, and The Impacts of Impervious Cover on Aquatic Systems. He is working on a wide range of research projects and watershed applications to improve the tools used for watershed protection and restoration. It is our pleasure to have Tom Schuller speaking to us today. Good afternoon, Tom.
Thank you very much, and welcome everyone. Webcast, my first webcast, and I can't see anybody out there. Probably glad that you could join us. The topic of this webcast is watershed protection. But before we get too far along, if you can move slide number two, I just wanted to tell you a little bit about the Center for Watershed Protection. We're a not-for-profit organization, not advocacy, based in Ellicott City. We work around the country with watershed groups, local, state, and federal governments to help provide tools to protect local streams, lakes, and rivers. Two websites on the screen. The first is our organizational website, and that's a good website to check out about new information and products and workshops conducted by the institute. Second, www.stormwatercenter.net, a more comprehensive source dealing with stormwater management. Center has a staff of 20, and we work in five program areas shown in slide number three. Watershed research to look at what is impacting our streams, lakes, and estuaries. Basically refine and improve practices to mitigate the impact of land development. Watershed applications, five practices in real-world watershed settings around the country. Learning, publications, and workshops. Work actively with capacity of watershed organizations. Move to slide four, the themes of the talk today are to start with impervious cover and how it's a very strong predictor of stream, lake, and wetland quality. Bulk of the talk, however, will be on the eight tools of watershed protection to protect aquatic resources from the impacts of land development. We'll conclude the webcast today with the Center's famous watershed behavior quiz, test our knowledge on our own personal stewardship behaviors, how they impact environmental quality. Moving to slide number five, important to define what is impervious cover. Impervious cover is simply any surface that's impenetrable rainfall, so rainfall cannot soak into the ground. In the slide, a parking lot is impervious, so at a rooftop, but sometimes even dirt roads, oyster shell parking lots, other highly compacted surfaces, are impervious cover. Now to slide six, it shows an aerial photograph of suburban development showing some of the major components of impervious cover, the land. Five, that impervious cover is composed of parking lots, roads, driveways, buildings, and sidewalks, major elements of impervious cover. What's really important to understand is that most suburban areas, thirds, all impervious cover, voted to car habitat. That's the areas where people park cars, drive cars, store cars. So, we'll be getting back to that statistic later on in the talk as a possible management strategy. I wanted you all to bookmark it for a minute. Classes 5 to 7, I'd like to go through a sequence of slides that show a specific watershed. Watershed is known as Wasp Branch, located outside of Washington, D.C., about 30 square miles. Slide number 7, we had it existed in 1940s, but it was primarily a rural area. Paul Village then, of Rockville, is shown on the right-hand side. Just a fair amount of development, but the majority of it was undeveloped in pasture.
Hey, Tom, this is Susan. We're getting a request that you could possibly move a little closer to the microphone, and I'd like to remind everybody to put their phones on mute because we're getting some background noise.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is this better?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Tom.
In slide 8, we're now in the 1950s, and if you look at and compare it to the previous slide, you can see a new interstate highway is bisecting the watershed, and it's the gateway to future growth. Moving to the next slide, slide number 9, you begin to see that growth take place throughout the 1960s. In slide 10, you can see that almost about 25% of the watershed is now black, showing the rapid growth of impervious cover in less than 4 decades. The slide sequence concludes with number 11 that shows Wasp Branch that existed in 1999, where it's completely built out, save 2 parcels shown in light blue that are now currently under construction. So the final impervious cover for this watershed is about 30%. We'll explain a little bit later the impacts of that on the streams in Watts Branch. But again, if you want to toggle between, again, slide number 7 and slide number 12, I'm sorry, slide number 11. So 7 and 11, you can see 3 major changes have occurred. Impervious cover has increased to 30%. Forest cover has declined to less than 5%, and curiously, turf cover has increased to about 20% of the watershed as it now exists. The next sequence of slides we'll go through show aerial photos of common land uses and the impervious cover that they create. The first slide, number 12, shows fairly low-density land uses. The top panel shows agriculture. The bottom shows 2-acre lot residential zoning. The center did a study about 5 or 6 years ago where we analyzed several hundred land uses around the Chesapeake Bay to derive the statistics that you'll see in front of you. But the agricultural area, a lot of people think agriculture has no impervious, but on average it has about 2% impervious cover, reflecting farm structures, but more commonly, the road system, the rural road system. The 2-acre lot residential category is shown in the bottom panel. That averages almost 10.6% impervious cover. And again, if you look at the screen closely, it's really not the size of the rooftop that's the problem. That's pretty much the same in all zoning categories. It's the length of the driveway and the road system needed to serve each individual house. So that's moving to slightly more dense land uses, as shown in slide 13, we look at 1-acre lots and half-acre lots, and the impervious cover for those land uses begins to climb, averaging about 14% for the 1-acre lots and about 21% for the half-acre lots. And what was really interesting about the study that we did is we didn't find much difference in the same zoning category in different counties in both Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. So these numbers are fairly reliable. Moving on to slide 14, we can see a couple of industrial and commercial land uses. The first thing I'd like you all to note is look at the rooftops first and then compare it to the car habitat that surrounds it. And typically, again, we have this two-thirds ratio of car car habitat to rooftop habitat in the slide. Another key feature is that these statistics apply to suburban development built in the last 15 or 20 years. Older development tends to be more compact and have higher impervious cover than shown here. And that's why for commercial development these days, it's hard to get 100% impervious because we have various setbacks, stormwater ponds, and environmental conservation requirements that reduce overall net impervious area. Okay, the next slide, number 15, is a pretty important one. It shows the impervious cover model, which is kind of a synthesis of stream research from around the country. There's been about 200 scientific studies that have looked at various indicators of stream quality versus the total amount of watershed impervious cover in smaller watersheds. The impervious cover model applies to watersheds or streams less than fourth order, so first, second, third, fourth order streams and rivers. It doesn't really apply to large river basins. But as you can see, there's really three classifications. It shows that at approximately 10% impervious cover, we lose our capability to maintain sensitive aquatic resources. A second threshold occurs at about 25% impervious cover, which is when we see significant impacts across the board in our urban streams. Beyond 25%, that category is defined as non-supporting, where streams no longer meet water quality standards, do not attain the biological diversity, and have many severe erosion problems. And in fact, beyond 60% impervious cover, we usually lose the stream entirely through enclosure, piping, or culverting. So it's really hard to find a stream in a watershed with more than 60% impervious cover. Moving on to slide 16, it's important to make the disclaimer as shown here that the model is a general model. It may not apply to every stream, and there are important factors like stream gradient, ages of watershed development, and management practices that can alter the model. And as you can see, the other legal language from the center on the slide. It's important to figure out how to apply the model properly, and hopefully we can get to some of those issues and questions during the first break, which is scheduled in just a few minutes. All right, moving to slide 17, this is a sequence of four aerial photos from the East Coast showing small watersheds, in most cases 2 or 3 square miles in size or less. The first one shows what 10% impervious cover looks like. You can see in the slide a fair amount of watershed development over in the upper right-hand side. But much of the stream corridor has been preserved. The catchment boundaries are outlined in red. The stream network is outlined in blue. You can see, just much like a leaf, that you have pretty good venation. That is, the stream network is throughout almost the total area of the subwatershed. Moving to slide 18, we see a watershed with 30% impervious cover. It has residential use in the bottom and a fairly large retail shopping center on the top. And the most important thing to look for on this slide is note how the stream network is missing from both the bottom side and the upper right-hand side. So essentially, this represents the enclosure or loss of headwater streams and their replacement by storm drainage. Slide 19 shows a watershed with, I believe it is, 60% impervious cover. You can see this is a large regional mall next to an interstate. And in this case, the stream network has disappeared entirely and is replaced by a stormwater pond, which is the large facility present about 2 inches below where it says 60% impervious cover. If you have a pretty good resolution screen, you can see some thin black lines that show the drainage ditches that replaced what once was a stream network. Moving on to slide 20, we see a watershed with more than 75% impervious cover. In this case, there no longer is a surface stream network at all. Everything is now underground, storm drain pipes and culverts. And the storm water generated from all the impervious cover discharges at the very bottom of the watershed, right in the middle of the screen, into the, in this case, the Charles River up in Boston. Okay, I think whenever you see this red slide with a hallucinatory watershed in it, we can take a break for questions. I put a question on the screen in case no one has any, but I think our moderator will be asking some questions.
I do have a question for you, Tom, and I still have a comment from folks. There's a lot of static, so I don't know if it's possible if you're on speakerphone, if you can pick up your phone, and I don't know for sure where it's coming from, but that might help. And also I'd like to remind people to please put your phones on mute. And in the meantime, Tom, we have a question from Jacqueline in New Jersey, and she writes, do you consider semi-impervious cover, such as lawns, into the effects on water bodies?
That's a great question, Jacqueline. There is a lot of research that indicates that lawns are highly compacted and act more like an impervious surface than a natural one. But in general practice, we do not distinguish between turf cover and other forms of cover. So I guess it's a weaselly answer on my part, but when we measure impervious cover over a watershed, we base it on the buildings, paved surfaces, and so forth, and lawns are generally not part of that calculation.
Okay, and I'd like to give an opportunity for folks on the phone to ask a question, if there's anybody out there who has a question related to the first 20 slides that we've seen today. Now is your time to take your phone off mute and ask a question.
Here is New York talking.
Okay.
What would be the effect of the accuracy in the impervious cover percentage determination on the impervious cover model?
That's a good question. What is the accuracy or the standard error along the, I believe you're referring to slide 15? Generally speaking, I'll show a couple of data slides in the next sequence that will give you a sense about the variability. There is variability around the line, and it depends, the exact nature of the variability depends on each individual stream indicator that is monitored.
Okay, great. Is there anyone else on the phone who would like to ask a question?
Yeah, we have a question in Region 7.
Okay, go ahead, Region 7.
Yeah, Tom, can you tell me, has there been any linkage between the model that you've developed and the loss of species in those stream systems?
Yeah, there's a considerable amount of evidence in almost every region of the country showing the loss of fish diversity, aquatic insect diversity, and even amphibian diversity. And I'll show a couple slides of that in just a few minutes.
All right, Tom, we also have a question from Rory in Texas, and he says he's concerned that there's an implication of cause and effect on the level of impervious cover when the stream treatment can make a major difference.
Yeah, that's a good question. In some cases, the cause and effect in the model is very direct and very significant, and I'll show you a few examples of that in a minute. In other areas, it's an association that impervious cover is associated with higher levels of problems. And we'll try to distinguish that in the next sequence, but I think Rory raises a very good point. It's not always a deterministic model. And one of the real big issues in our field today is what is the impact of our various management practices in reversing the impervious model. Are there any other questions, or can we move on?
Region 7 again. You know, Tom, is the biggest impact for the impervious cover is the pollutants in the stormwater?
I think the biggest impact with impervious cover is related to stormwater runoff and its impact on the habitat quality of urban streams. And we'll show that in just a minute. And no, Nikos, I'm not on a cell phone.
Can we ask everybody once again to put their phones on mute, except for Tom, so that we won't have as much background noise? And if you don't have a mute button, you can use the asterisk and the 6 to put your phone on mute. Tom, you want to go ahead and return back to your slides?
Super. And I'll try to speak as loud as I can.
Thank you.
All right. The moving to slide 22, let's look at the research. There's been about 150 studies on the relationship between impervious cover and aquatic indicators in the last 10 years or so. And the center has compiled a report that documents those studies if anybody wants any more detail on the individual studies. But let me go through some of the general evidence to support the model, starting with slide 23. There are a lot of different indicators that we can use to look at the quality of aquatic systems. The first group deals with hydrologic indicators, and I'm showing on the screen five bullets of the most common effects of land development and impervious cover. You see an increase in stormwater runoff, an increased frequency of flooding, the floodplain expands, and during dry weather periods, generally, we have diminished base flow, except for certain regions of the country that are either highly urban or semi-arid or arid, where actually urban stream flows increase during base flow conditions because of irrigation return flow. Moving to slide 24, it's a pretty important slide. I'm going to take a few minutes to go through it. Shows watershed imperviousness going from 0 to 100% on the bottom scale, and the runoff coefficient between 0 and 1 on the side scale. Now, the runoff coefficient expresses for a given amount of rainfall what proportion is converted into runoff. So in this case, if the runoff coefficient is 1, if we had a 1-inch rainstorm, all of it would be converted into runoff. If you look at the bottom left-hand side of the screen, you can see in the undeveloped areas, runoff coefficients tend to be very low, typically between 0.02 and 0.1, which means that 2 to 10% of rainfall is converted into runoff. And that variation is due to things like soils and slope and forest cover. As we add more impervious cover, you can see that the runoff coefficient relationship increases. By the time we have 80 or 90% impervious cover, the runoff coefficient tends to be about 0.9 or even 1. So the key point here is a fairly obvious one, that impervious cover produces runoff. I forgot to mention on slide 24, this comes from some research done during the Nationwide Urban Runoff Program study in the early 1980s. And each of those dots represents a single urban monitoring station that was monitored for 10 to 20 storm events from around the country. So it's a pretty strong relationship. For the gentleman that asked the question about the variation, that's a typical level of scatter that we see with hydrologic indicators. Moving on to slide 25, we see what most citizens understand about urban streams, which is they flood a lot. Because of the increased runoff volume, you get an increased rate of discharge for the same rainfall event.
So when you get the really big rainfall event, it means that the floodplain expands significantly and you have a higher risk of flooding. Almost 50 people die each year in the country from urban flash flooding, and more than $3 billion of private property, or I'm sorry, public property infrastructure gets damaged. Moving along to slide 26, let's look at the physical indicators of stream quality. We've already looked at a few. For example, the loss of headwater streams that we profiled in the slides right before the break. We also see encroachment into the floodplain. We lose the riparian forested buffer, if that's what our local reference vegetation is. We get an increased number of crossings, of pipelines, of bridges, culverts that create barriers to fish migration, and they physically interrupt the stream and turn it into a series of segments rather than a continuous network, which is much more common in a natural setting. One of the things, moving to slide 27, is we have stream habitat indicators as well. And these indicators are largely influenced by that increased frequency of flow. And what that does is it enlarges the channel and it increases the sediment load. At the same time this is occurring, we lose stream habitat, woody debris, and we tend to warm the stream up. When we move to slide 28, it's an interesting slide. It shows several second-order streams ranging from less than 5%, 8 to 10%, 20%, 30%, 65%. You can see that channel enlargement or widening process taking place. In particular, if you look at the 20% stream, you can see a stormwater outfall and the pipes coming out of the bank. That was originally set at the elevation of the stream, and so you can see there's been at least 4 feet of downward erosion and about 6 feet of bankward erosion. So think for a minute over several miles of stream what a massive quantity of sediment is delivered downstream by that channel erosion process. Moving on to slide 29, think back to the Watts Branch slide, the one that went from the 1940s to the 50s. That system was measured by Luna Leopold, one of the great geomorphologists of our country and the son of Aldo Leopold. This is a shot from his book, A View of the River, which shows a stream cross-section that he measured when Watts Branch was rural, mostly in pasture. Let's advance to slide 30, and you can see the same cross-section and how much larger it's become. Going to slide 31 is probably a better way to measure the change. It's a little bit of complicated, but on the left-hand axis, we have the elevation, relative elevation in feet. In the other axis, we have the cross-section distance in feet looking downstream. So imagine that you're in the middle of the stream looking downstream. The lightest blue is the historic cross-section that Leopold measured in 1954. The darker blue shows the current cross-section that center staff measured in 1999, and you can see that the channel is now twice as wide and almost once again as deep as it was in 1950. And the process of channel enlargement is not instantaneous. It can take 3 to 5 decades to fully manifest itself. So according to some modeling that's been done, the ultimate cross-section might look like the one shown in the darkest purple, which has almost 3 times the cross-sectional area. Moving along to slide 32, this is some data collected from 3 regions of the country, the Vermont, Texas, and Maryland. And shows a generalized relationship of something called the channel enlargement ratio, again as a function of impervious cover. There's scatter around the line, which is typical, but the trend is fairly significant. The channel enlargement ratio simply expresses how much wider is, or how much larger in cross-sectional area is the channel compared to its original condition prior to development. So if the ratio is 1, it means it hasn't changed. If the ratio is 2, it means it's twice as big. If the ratio is 4, it means the cross-sectional area is 4 times what it once was. As you can see here, at about 10 or 15% impervious cover, you're beginning to see channels that are twice their cross-sectional area. And when we continue up the curve toward your right, at about 60%, you're even 4, 5, 6 times the cross-sectional area. So the channel enlargement, to answer the question that was asked earlier, is probably the most direct severe impact associated with impervious cover that can be tied directly or causally to the presence of upstream impervious cover. The next group of indicators involve water quality, which are shown on slide 33. In urban watersheds, we frequently have violations of bacteria standards. It's not uncommon during storms for fecal coliform levels to be 20 to 50 times above water contact recreational standards. Urban runoff also contains nutrients at fairly high levels that can cause eutrophication, not only in lakes but in streams and rivers. There's a fair amount of metals that can cause toxicity to aquatic life or contaminate sediments. But probably what the public notices the most are trash and debris loads, incredible volumes of material sent downstream. Slide 34 contains a longer list of the pollutants found in urban runoff and urban streams. I just want to touch briefly on the fact that we also have high levels of petroleum hydrocarbons, high levels of organic carbon, but not the kind of organic carbon that aquatic insects like. We also see high levels of pesticides in urban streams during base flow, which reflects urban lawn applications as well as municipal applications to rogue right-of-ways. In the most recent USGS study, herbicides were found in 100% of urban streams across the country. De-icers include the salt and sands applied to our roadway system, and those can be very high in the wintertime in our more northern climates. Okay, let's move on to the last group of indicators. These relate to aquatic diversity, and biologists have a whole series of different metrics they can use to look at the quality of the stream relative to some reference to a good quality stream in a more rural area. So in this list, we have things like aquatic insects, sensitive insect species, fish diversity, the presence of indicator species like trout or salmon or some kind of amphibian, or even the species diversity of plants in the wetland or floodplain. So all of those have been analyzed, although much of the work across the country has been done in the first four bullets. Much less has been done with wetlands and amphibians. Moving to slide 36, I see it's time for a break, so why don't we take some of the questions from the moderator.
Okay, Tom, we have a question from Robert in Puerto Rico, and he wants to know, is there a correlation between shallow streams and water quality? And if everyone else besides Tom could please put their phone on mute. Thank you.
I think there is a correlation between shallow streams and water quality, if I have his question correct.
Yes, that is the question.
Yeah, and then he's also asked, are there studies that consider the effect of implementation of BMPs? I think that's a real important question, and we'll discuss that a little bit later, but the answer is there haven't been a lot of really good studies to look at the impact of VMPs on the impervious cover model. The studies that have been done to date have had some flaws, and many of the studies have been conducted in watersheds that have at least some degree of VMP treatment. So right now we can't answer that question definitively, and from a planning standpoint, until we know the answer, I think it's wise to be cautious about the effect of VMPs on the impervious cover model.
Okay, great. Is there someone on the telephone that would like to ask a question to Tom? And you can't take your phone off mute to ask a question.
This is Kim Johnson in Region 7.
Okay, Kim.
On slide 23, for hydrological indicators, you state that there's a diminished base flow. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Diminished base flow means during dry weather, if it hasn't rained for a week or so, do you have more or less flow in the stream that comes from shallow groundwater? And the reasoning is the more impervious cover that you have, the less recharge or infiltration of groundwater will occur because all the rainfall runs off directly and never gets into the ground. So in many of the settings that we work in, we see during a drought period that urban streams dry up well before rural streams do. But as I mentioned when I showed that slide, there are cases in very highly urban areas and in arid areas where we introduce new flows to our urban streams, whether it be from irrigation return water, from lawn irrigation, or in some cases, as much as 25% of all the drinking water never gets to the tap and reaches the stream through leaks and cracks in the pipe system, and actually in some cases can increase base flows. Particularly the case in older communities like in Baltimore, Maryland, very old city, the flows in their streams and underground areas are much higher than would be expected because we're now containing good old drinking water. And by the way, we look at fluoride usually as the marker for knowing that.
All right, Tom, someone in Florida has written a question. Evidently, they have some information from a study testing VMPs, and they say, results of a study conducted in southeast Florida, i.e. South Miami-Dade Watershed Land Use Study, indicated that the conversion of agricultural lands abundant in West Miami to residential developments would actually improve water quality in downtown due to the stringent VMPs implemented. Also, several projects under Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Project assumes new developments would improve water quality due to VMPs versus voluntary VMPs applied by agriculture uses. They would like to know your opinion about this Florida study.
Well, I love to comment on studies I've never read.
There you go.
Take my answer with a grain of salt. But it's actually a fairly common question. It has two parts. The first part is if you have an agricultural area that's heavily cropped and you convert it, does it get better or worse? And if the question is asked only with respect to nutrients, the argument is, in some cases, is that urban development may be no worse than a highly cropped agricultural area. But if we're looking at all of the indicators, things like aquatic diversity, stream sediment loading, stream habitat, stream interruption, it's very clear that VMPs alone can't mitigate all those impacts. The analogy I like to use is for those of you out there that have kids, as I do, when they're first born, you have a lot of expectations for them. You want them to be, you know, clean, healthy, reverent, intelligent, respectful, et cetera, et cetera. And after 18 years, when they finally graduate, as thankfully mine just did last week, you're just happy if they get a job and move out of the house. And the point is, VMPs can do a few things well, but they can't mitigate an entire list of 20 or 25 impacts that we've just gone over. So I hope that answers the gentleman's question.
That's great, Tom. I'm afraid that it's time to move on to the next slide, but that was a great discussion.
All right. Next slide is number 37, and I just put this one in here to show the meanest-looking aquatic insect I could find. So that's a mean aquatic insect. If someone knows its species, I've always wanted to know, so tell me at the next break. 38 is, again, a filler slide of fish, and I guess the point of showing this is that in small streams, first and second order streams, we tend to have fewer fish species than in larger rivers. But we typically, at least in my region, which would be the Maryland Piedmont, we have typically 8 to 12 species of fish. Moving on to slide 39, it shows some data from about 70 small streams in Fairfax County, Virginia. It computes a variable called the Index of Biological Integrity, which it looks at 10 different metrics of the fish community and combines them into a score, much like a grade on a test, with 100 being the best reference possible and 0 being depth, I guess. And you can see there's a lot of scatter in the relationship. The trend line is shown in red. It goes from the northwest to the southeast. But there is a fair amount of variability. But notice the upper right-hand quadrant. There's nothing there at all. And essentially, as we get more impervious cover, we lose the ability to be good. Also notice in the upper left-hand corner at 5% impervious cover, we can score anywhere between 40, which is not a very healthy fish community, to 100%. So just because we're under 10% doesn't necessarily mean that we have great fish diversity. We have the potential for it, but other factors like acid mine drainage or agricultural practices, lack of stream buffers, and so forth, can reduce the fish IBI score. And so the basic notion in our practice right now is we want to try to move dots below the line, above the line, and that's really the goal of stream restoration. Okay, we're almost through with impervious cover, but as I mentioned before, impervious cover is also associated with a number of other impacts, and I'll just mention them briefly. The more impervious cover you have, the higher the air temperature, the greater the pollutant emissions, primarily because you have more vehicle miles traveled. You have higher metal and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon levels in sediments, a greater degree of forest fragmentation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So those are just some of the other associations that researchers are looking at right now. Impervious cover is not the only indicator that we can use. And as you see in slide 41, there are other watershed indicators that are pretty powerful. One, of course, is watershed forest cover. There's been some intriguing research, mostly in the Pacific Northwest, that indicates that if we can have at least two-thirds forest cover in the watershed, we can attain excellence. In addition, where that forest cover is located is important. If about 65% of the stream network is retained mature forest cover in those areas of the country that still have, that don't have, where you have a forest cover in the riparian area, we can attain high quality. And other factors like road density, ages of watershed development, stormwater pond density, all seem to be useful indicators, particularly when we are less than 10% impervious cover. And to answer one of the questions asked earlier, I'd also say crop cover is important, that if we had two watersheds, one that had 65% forest cover, one that had 65% crop cover, but they both had less than 2% impervious cover, we would expect the watershed with the higher forest cover to be in much better shape biologically and water quality-wise. Okay, that kind of concludes the impervious cover review. Now we're going to shift over to the 8 tools of watershed protection. And these were developed by the center to kind of find or identify the things communities have to do to protect and manage their aquatic resources in the face of land development. And I'll discuss them in turn, but essentially the key point is we need to do all 8 of the things shown in the little footballs on the screen, from where development goes, which is really watershed planning, to conserving the last best places, to putting in buffers around our aquatic areas, to designing better development with less impervious cover, to imposing erosion controls during land development, stormwater treatment, and so forth and so on. Watershed planning is the first tool. It's probably the most important tool in the toolbox. As we can see in slide 44, the watershed planning, at least as how we do it at the center, is not on really big watersheds. It tends to be on really small watersheds. We call those small watersheds sub-watersheds, and they tend to be less than 10 square miles in area. And I'm going to skip to slide 45 because it's time for another of our breaks.
All right, Tom, we have one question that's still on impervious surface. This is from Catherine in New Hampshire, and she wants to know if there's any information on distance to stream of impervious cover within watersheds regarding impacts. So is it worse to put a parking lot a quarter mile from a stream or somewhere else in a watershed?
Excellent question, and there's not been a great deal of research on that topic, but the research that has been done shows the location of impervious cover in a watershed is not a particularly important factor, which surprises a lot of people. But think about your parking lot for a minute. That parking lot is going to have a storm drain pipe leading from it, and that storm drain pipe in most cases will extend directly to the stream, therefore short circuiting any stream buffer that exists. So that's why, particularly as we get more intense development, the location of impervious cover is less important. Having said that, there is no, that's not a reason not to have wide stream buffers. Stream buffers are a very important watershed planning tool, and we'll talk about them in a minute. But the basis for stream buffers or the justification for them is somewhat different.
Okay, great. Would anyone on the telephone like to ask Tom a question?
Tom, this is headquarters here. The question is related to the last question. If development is imminent, what part of a watershed should be developed? Or said in another way, how would you prioritize where development will have the least impact on the watershed?
Excellent. And if you can wait for just a few slides, we'll try to explain where is the best place to do it. But generally speaking, the short answer is you want to keep it away from the headwater streams if you have an opportunity to do so. And in fact, if we move to, are there any more questions? And actually, if we could move on, I think I'm running a little bit behind.
Let's go ahead and move on, Tom.
Slide 46 shows what the gentleman just asked, which is it's a watershed. It happens to be the Powhatan Creek watershed in Virginia. And it's what you see on the left-hand side is about 25 square miles in size. But that big watershed is broken down into about 11 small watersheds, that one of which is broken out on the sidebar on the right. And that's the real trick in watershed planning. You work at the watershed level, but you break that watershed into smaller sub-watersheds. You look at the actual amount of development forecast for each. In fact, we'll see in a moment the effect of or how you would do that. So anyway, let's talk about the management implications of the impervious cover model. We have some watersheds that have about 2 to 10% impervious cover, as shown in slide 47. The model predicts that most indicators will be good or excellent, although that is not automatic. Some may decline because of poor land management practices in the past or in the present. Important to note, some individual indicators are even more sensitive. I can think of species like brook trout, Barton Spring salamander, and others that may show a decline at 5 or 6 or 7% impervious cover. So if you're trying to manage, you know, a trout or a specific single resource, don't be fooled by the 10% limit. It may actually be less. But as I noted before, impervious cover is not as powerful in this zone as things like forest cover, riparian forest cover, which is the RFC shown on your screen, and turf cover. Move along to slide 48. What are the planning implications of the sensitive streams? Well, it predicts that even low-intensity residential development will degrade streams, even with some degree of watershed treatment. If you recall from the earlier slide, 2-acre lot and 1-acre lot residential development have had 10 and 15% impervious cover, respectively. So the traditional practice of large lot zoning may not be sufficient to protect our streams or our reservoirs from the impact of land development. So our response is to have aggressive down zoning, land conservation buffers. Generally, it's not a good idea to sewer sensitive watersheds. It's important. You can't save every stream, but the ones that are most important, definitely try to limit impervious cover. I won't go into all the planting techniques today, but as you see in slide 49, there are two references the center has put out. One is called The Practice of Watershed Protection. The other is The Rapid Watershed Planting Handbook. They go through the range of land use planning and other tools that we have used in our practice. And I think both books are a good start if you want to look at managing those kind of resources. And typically, as you see in slide 50, it shows Yarmouth Creek in Virginia, and it shows the zoning it currently has. And the screen is all pretty much green, and that's an agricultural one dwelling unit per 40 acres. And in this case, they're going to maintain the zoning designation, which means that this very high-quality stream with wonderful wetland complexes will be maintained over time. So it's just an example of one land use planning technique that can help maintain the quality of those sensitive streams. Okay, let's go back to Powhatan Creek. That's slide 51. We saw this one earlier, and this is just a reprise of that slide. This watershed drains to the James River right at Jamestown, the first European settlement in North America. So what we did in our watershed plan was we measured the watershed, the sub-watershed areas. We measured the current impervious cover and the future impervious cover using techniques that were in those earlier two books. Flip to slide 52. It shows for the 12 sub-watersheds, for 1998, 2000, and 2020, what their designation was. So when we went out in the field, we found 8 sensitive streams and 4 impacted and 0 non-supporting. In the course of our study, just shows how rapidly urbanization can take place, we lost 2 sensitive streams. And without any watershed planning, we showed the county commissioners that by 2020 they would lose all of their sensitive streams. This is a powerful example of how the impervious cover model can be used to educate local officials that if they stand by and do nothing, they'll lose many of the environmental qualities that people have come to like. Another use of the impervious cover model is shown in slide 53, which is a Maryland watershed called the Bush River really nice system, still pretty rural area. We looked at the current impervious cover in each of its 30 sub-watersheds and the future impervious cover. We also looked at some other watershed metrics, like septic systems and manure applications and so forth. It allowed us to identify which watersheds were most sensitive to future development. So the one in tan and yellow were projected to have the greatest change, and therefore special development regulations were put together for those sub-watersheds. Slide 54 is just a summary of why watershed planning is so hard in many communities. Many communities are overzoned. By that I mean the zoning they have in the books, if it's ever built out, will produce more impervious cover than they can possibly deal with. So they have a very hard choice in their hands about how to deal with that legacy. There's also uncertainty about the BMP effect. Many communities, the feeling is if we just put in BMPs, we can avoid the impervious cover model. There's confusion about how to do watershed plans. And very few communities actually have a watershed zoning unit. That is a very, very low density, perhaps 1 to 20, 1 to 40, 1 to 80 acre use. Let's switch to impacted streams while we're on top of watershed planning. That would be slide 55. The impervious cover model predicts they show signs of declining stream health with most indicators in the fair to good category, but they're not completely written off. They usually have a good stream corridor. Usually some land available to implement practices. And these streams tend to have the highest restoration potential out there because they're only lightly developed and quite a bit of room is available for practice. Moving to slide 56, the watershed planning strategy for these kind of sub-watersheds are to apply all 8 tools of watershed protection that we're speaking about now, and also set goals for retaining the maximum amount of forest cover and streamside cover as possible. Slide 57 shows a typical watershed plan. Again, this is the Powhatan Creek plan. Let's go to slide 58, though. A watershed plan is really, in our view, not a book or a big report. It's usually a fairly detailed map that shows where development will go and where it won't go, where buffers will exist, where land conservation will take place. So it's very important to show it spatially and to have these maps adopted so that when a developer comes in, they know where the boundaries are, and it's essentially a master plan for the environmental actions taken in the watershed. Our last category are non-supporting streams, and they go from 25 to 100%. They're a particularly tough group because they don't support a range of designated uses. Stream indicators are fair to poor to non-existent. Stream at the lowest end of the category shows some promise for stream restoration. Just because they may not meet standards in the near future doesn't mean we should write them off. It means we really need to work hard to improve the appearance of the stream corridor, to reduce pollutants downstream, and at least have some kind of goal to allow water contact recreation during dry weather so that if our dogs or children go in the water, they won't get sick. Moving to slide 60, these non-supporting streams are really tough because they're not likely to ever support the full range of designated uses laid out in the Clean Water Act. And if we believe in smart growth, as many of us do, these are the kind of watersheds where we want to promote more active redevelopment that might increase impervious cover further. So they're kind of a challenge. Some communities and states are thinking about an urban drainage classification for these streams, but they're a real challenge, and maybe we'll have a little discussion about that at the end. Again, as we go to slide 61, a watershed plan for a non-supporting stream is less about land use It's about stream restoration, stormwater retrofitting, reforestation, of trying to put back together the components that were broken long ago. And in slide 61, we see our beloved Watts Branch again. You're probably getting tired of Watts Branch. But it shows the restoration plan, the center, the city of Rockville put together. About 25 stormwater retrofits and about 15 major stream restoration projects, as well as a lot of public education. And the goal is that by doing all this, we'll be able to perhaps turn what is now a non-supporting stream into an impacted one. We'll never be able to get back to pre-development, but it'll be a better resource than it was before. So watershed restoration isn't today's topic, but I couldn't do something like this without shamelessly plugging the center's new small watershed restoration manual series, which is shown on slide 62. The center's put together five manuals and has several more in production that basically go through the techniques to restore urban streams and urban watersheds. So those manuals are a good resource, and you can check out at our website how to get a copy of them. I think the one on urban stream repair practices is still available for free download, so you might want to do that. The others, unfortunately, cost a little money. So we're at slide 63. Time for a break.
All right, Tom, I've got a question from Don in Portland, Oregon, and he said, thanks for mentioning the importance of not sewering sensitive watersheds. Would you please elaborate on the reasons a little bit?
Yeah, it's not that I love septic systems, because septic systems can be a source of significant nitrogen pollution. But basically, once you put in a sewer, it causes two problems. One, the sewer usually goes down the stream corridor, because the stream corridor is the most gravity-efficient way to go from your toilet to the sewage treatment plant. And often the physical installation of the sewer adjacent to or underneath the existing stream can be a serious impact in its own right. But the main thing about sewers is that you can't, if you have sewers, you're generally going to have impervious cover well in excess of 10%. Because in most parts of the country, once a sewer is built, anyone can tap into it, and it's always an incentive for future growth.
Okay, great. Would anybody on the telephone like to ask a question?
This is the Federal Relay RCC captioner for Ann Burgett.
Okay.
She's stating that they can't hear the speaker.
I'm talking as loud as I can. Is that any better?
She should provide a phone. If you want to type in with a phone number, we can have someone call them, because we can definitely hear where we are.
This is Region 7. Can you elaborate on downzoning, please?
Yeah, downzoning is political suicide. Now, downzoning simply means that you take the current zoning, which might be one-acre lot residential, and creating a less dense category, perhaps one dwelling unit per 40 acres. Or on a watershed scale, if you're basically taking the existing zoning and having less density than originally proposed. And it's a difficult choice for local governments to do, because people have vested interest in being able to subdivide their land.
Again, everyone but Tom, please put your phone on mute unless you're the person being called on to ask a question. Thank you. Go ahead.
This is headquarters again.
You're going to have to pick up. I can't hear you.
Headquarters again. I had a question about restoration of riparian buffer zones. I know that they're being increasingly used as management tools to improve water quality, but do you have any statistics regarding just how significant they are for actual reduction of stormwater runoff, especially like in urban areas?
Excellent question, and I would have to say that while we know a heck of a lot about how urban stream buffers improve biological diversity of streams and their temperature, we have very few good studies on their pollutant removal efficiency or the reduction in runoff volume that you were speaking about. And I think both should be important priorities for research, because those are questions that local elected officials are asking across the country. They kind of intuitively know buffers are good, but they want more scientific data so that they can get them adopted in their own communities.
Yeah, this may be a related question, Tom. Laura from New Jersey says, can you please clarify, quote, what is a watershed zoning unit and how can municipalities incorporate them into their zoning?
Yeah, a watershed zoning unit means that, you know, most communities in the United States have some kind of zoning, and it's usually based on the number of dwelling units or the gross floor area if it's a commercial or the intended land use like industrial, institutional, commercial. When communities look at their zoning, they usually don't have a natural resource zoning unit or a watershed unit that's just there to protect the quality of a reservoir or to protect an area in rural character. And so because they lack it, they may want to consider adding that to their current list of zoning categories. And that offers a real tool to protect and manage land in low density.
Okay, great. Thank you, Tom. I think it's time to move on to slide 64.
Excellent. Slide 64 is land conservation, and we'll move on to slide 65. This land conservation is the second tool, and it's real important to find the critical habitats, to preserve the aquatic corridor, to maintain farm cover, protect cultural and historic areas, and deal with water pollution hazards. You see in the slide 65 on the bottom right, a tank farm. And, you know, some watersheds, like a drinking water watershed, you wouldn't necessarily want to have above ground petroleum storage or certain kind of land uses. So conservation areas are one of the first areas that we systematically analyze when putting together a watershed plan. Slide 66 shows a series of photos, but if you look at the biggest one, that's our friend Howerton Creek again, and it shows aerial photo of all the sites that we identified for wetlands, mature forests, and rare threatened endangered species. And these are really important to find the best examples of quality areas that we can. In the bottom left-hand side, you can't see it real well, but some very high-quality wetlands with a heron rookery in the background. There were four locations where there was a world pagonia, which is a rare, threatened, and endangered plant species. There were only three remaining high-quality interior forest habitats. So we went out using GIS to begin with, but then a series of field assessments to identify and rank the best conservation areas. And in some cases, conserving them through conservation easements, in other areas, land acquisition. And just a quick note, you know, we often find the public isn't always as motivated as we are about watershed planning. But when you start involving things like heron rookeries and neat plants and cool wetlands and high-quality trout streams and the like, it tends to increase the support for make more tangible watershed protection to the public. Let's talk about aquatic buffers. That's the third tool of watershed protection. Aquatic buffers we recommend is probably the cheapest, most effective tool we have out there. And it's anywhere from a 75 to 125-foot zone extending to the stream, on both sides of the stream. And there is no, the goal is to have mature forest cover adjacent to the stream. And as you get further out, you can have turf cover. But the important point is to have some distance between the stream and the development, which if we move to slide 69, you see an example of a 15-foot wide stream buffer. And it's a pretty scary slide showing virtually no, quite a bit of clearing and disturbing and tree removal next to the stream. So we want, wherever possible, 75 or 100 feet distance so that we have a stream corridor to play with years from now. And the other advantage is that by preserving essentially what is the floodplain in a natural state, we make sure the houses will not be harmed by future flooding. So it's a cheap form of flood insurance.
Can I ask everybody again besides Tom to put their phones on mute? We're picking up somebody else's conversation. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you. Slide 70 shows one of the big issues out there, which most communities say, how wide should the buffer be? And the answer to that is whatever you can get away with, I guess. But 100 feet is a serviceable number. But what most communities don't really realize is how to manage the buffer. It's not just the width. We need to figure out to make sure it's going to be maintained in a natural state, that certain stormwater controls are in place, and that tree clearing and allowable and unallowable uses are clearly outlined in the local stream ordinance. Some of the materials on the website will go through some of the architecture of stream buffers and some model ordinances if you're interested in that. Slide 71 introduces our fourth tool, which is better site design. And better site design is a series of simple techniques to change local codes, development codes, to reduce impervious cover, conserve natural areas, and improve stormwater treatment. And so the next four or five slides illustrate some of the key principles. Remember how car habitat was two-thirds of impervious cover? That's really the goal of better site design, is how we can put the car habitat on a diet. So as you see in slide 72, a traditional suburban cul-de-sac that you could probably land a couple of Huey helicopters on there, with the sidewalk that goes completely around the bulb, so only the, if any kid who walked that way on their way to the bus stop would get beat up by the time they got there, compared to the cul-de-sac with the island in the middle of a smaller diameter. So again, it's a small but simple way to reduce impervious cover. In slide 73, we see street width. Again, many local codes require 36 or even 40-foot wide residential roads where you can park just about anywhere. Narrower streets, 24 feet, 28 feet, 20 feet, are just as good, safer, cheaper, and produce less impervious cover. So changing local road codes is important. Slide 74 illustrates another element of better site design, which is open space or cluster subdivisions. The top left-hand side shows a not-so-good with large lot setbacks and so forth. So we have a lot of turf, a lot of driveways, a lot of roads. In the foreground, or the bottom right, we see an open space subdivision with narrower roads. The houses are somewhat closer together, but each house looks out to its own open space of forest, which is managed by the community as a whole. So what you get from going from the top right to the top left is smaller lots, closer houses, but much more natural area to serve. And these open space subdivisions have been shown to sell quicker and cost less to construct for developers. So they are a pretty good option. But in many communities in America today, the local building code makes you have to do the top left as opposed to the bottom right. In fact, the bottom right might be not allowed at all. Lastly, we get to parking lots, shown in slide 75. Parking lots tend to be vastly over-designed with more spaces than are actually used. Again, parking codes at the local level are very ripe for review to reduce the number of spaces, the size of spaces, and improve the degree of stormwater treatment provided within the parking lot. Moving to slide 76, we see a creative use of parking lot islands for stormwater treatment, where instead of just being functionless features, like the one on the top right-hand side, we have curb cuts which allow stormwater runoff to go into a landscaped area for treatment on the left-hand side. We can also deal with rooftop runoff in creative ways. That's shown in slide 77. Instead of having our rooftops directly connected to the paved areas or the storm drain network, we can disconnect them and spread them over grass and filter areas, or we can install rain barrels or cisterns that capture and store the runoff. You maybe use it to water our tomato plants in the summer. So here we are, ready for break at slide 78.
All right, Tom, I've got a question from D.C. Are there different recommendations for buffer widths depending on the stream type, intermittent or perennial?
Good question. Generally, you can get away with a somewhat smaller width for a perennial, for an intermittent stream compared to a perennial. And as you get higher stream orders, as you go to second, third, fourth, fifth order streams, they get larger. It's a good idea for your buffer to get wider, too. And the point about having a buffer on intermittent streams is really important because most communities don't specifically regulate them. Most communities actually use USGS blue lines shown on the USGS maps, and those are notoriously inaccurate, with all due respect to my friends in the Geological Survey. They only show about 40% of first-order streams. So many communities are now actually field ground truthing their stream networks so they can actually map on their own GIS systems the precise location of perennial and intermittent streams that they want to protect.
Tom?
Yes.
This is Miriam from Wisconsin. In the last section, someone had asked if there had been any studies looking at the impact of buffers on water quantity and storm runoff. And an interesting place you might put that question would be the Association of State Floodplain Managers. And they may have some studies in some of their past conferences. Their website is www.floods, that's F-L-O-O-D-S, as in Sam.org. And you can also get some interesting material there on their program, which is called No Adverse Impact, which is a way of managing floodplains on a watershed basis.
Excellent. Thank you for bringing that up. That's a great group, and they have, I believe, also a lot of good model ordinances.
Hello, this is Isabel in San Diego. Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead, Isabel.
Hi, I wonder if there are any good examples of a successful coordination of watershed planning with wildlife and habitat protection planning, such as the Natural Communities Conservation Programs in California?
That's a good question. I'm not familiar with the California program that you're specifically talking about, but I can think of several areas in the country you might want to look for. Clearly, many communities in the Pacific Northwest have tied salmon habitat explicitly in the context of their watershed planning. Other areas might be Austin, Texas, where they've been dealing with the habitat of both an endangered salamander in Barton Springs as well as several endangered bird species in the hill country that drains to it. So there are a number of examples where habitat has been pulled into watershed plans, and it's a great point. We should not always be fixated with water quality, but generally the public cares more about critters than DO.
Thank you.
Tom?
Yes.
John, here at headquarters, EPA. You mentioned local ordinances prohibiting things like cluster zoning and narrower streets. How can you encourage local communities to adopt better ordinances? Do you have a model ordinance, for example?
Well, actually, we have something called a COW, which is a codes and ordinance worksheet, and it's available, I believe, on our website under the Builders for the Bay logo. But essentially what it is, it's a test. It has 100 points, and it reviews 67 different areas of local codes. It often takes 3 to 5 days to complete, because most communities just have an enormous amount of codes to deal with. So they go through that process, and they score. And so far, it's been done in about 60 communities around the country, and the best score has been like 78. The lowest score was less than 20, and I'm not going to tell you where that was in terms of the Hall of Shame. So we start with that, and then the actual process to change the codes is something called a local roundtable, where it's a third-party facilitated process. It takes 6 months to a year, and it invites the developers, the local plan reviewers, the environmental groups, realtors, basically anybody involved in the development process. They go through an education component, they break into committees, and then look to recommend specific changes to specific ordinances that are then adopted in a single package by their elected leadership. And we could do a whole webcast on that process, but it's been pretty effective so far. We've done it 10 times and have been successful 9 times. So when a community is ready to do it, and the thing about it is developers don't like impervious cover. You know, it costs them money. So they love narrower streets. They love smaller cul-de-sacs. So they're willing to exchange, in some cases, more land conservation for less development infrastructure. And that's the real secret to making the development rules work. All right, any other questions?
Let's go ahead on to slide 79, Tom.
All right, 79 is our fifth tool, which is erosion and sediment control. Going to slide 80, we look at some of the elements of sediment control. It's the things that you see, the silt fence, the hydro seeding, the sediment ponds, the check dams. And they're really designed to reduce the amount of sediment delivered during what ranks as the most critical stage of land development, when we're physically, you know, putting the bulldozer and clearing equipment in the landscape. So I guess the key point here is the tool is to have a good erosion and sediment control program to make sure good practices are applied, but it's also about having clear limits on clearing and grading, making sure that stream buffers are shown on plans, to make sure that the minimum amount of clearing is done at each site and that soils are not compacted. So there's structures and practices, but there's also, if you will, pollution prevention by not clearing. Erosion and sediment control is one of the toughest tools to administer. If we go to slide 81, one of the things about erosion and sediment controls is they fail a lot, and they require constant maintenance to make sure that they're effective. You see here a silt fence next to a stream buffer that's been overwhelmed by erosion, and now the sediment is marching through the forest into the stream. So it's not just about good plans. We need to have third-party inspectors, contractors that are educated, that know that just putting up the silt fence isn't enough, that it's a routine part of construction to maintain it. All right, moving to slide 82, it shows another aspect of erosion and sediment control, which is rapid stabilization after clearing. You can see in the foreground, it's the winter time, and so they put a straw, a very extensive straw cover, 5 days after the area was cleared. You also notice in the background, there's a series of trees that represent the stream buffer. They've been very careful to make sure that construction equipment won't encroach into that important area. Our sixth tool is shown in slide 83. It's stormwater best management practices. If we go to slide 84, we'll talk a little bit about this tool in detail. You see in that slide 84, 5 raindrops of different sizes, and that's really our task when we're designing stormwater treatment systems. We have small raindrops that really don't produce much runoff and go into the ground. That, those are the storms that recharge groundwater. We have slightly bigger raindrops that are responsible for the majority of the pollutants that wash off into our streams. Even bigger storms are related to channel protection. Those are the ones that cause channel erosion, typically 1 to 2 inch rainfall events in my region of the country and in many parts elsewhere. Then we have the whopper storms that create floods that go out of bank, and then the 1 in 100 year storm events that create major flooding. So most of our stormwater systems are trying to do to control 5 different kind of rainfall events of different sizes. We have a series of stormwater practices that we can use, and I'll go through them fairly quickly. But if we go to slide 85, you see a conventional stormwater pond with a forebay leading to a deep pool that provides pollutant removal. During larger storm events, water is stored and released slowly. Slide 86 shows the second major kind of stormwater practice, which is the stormwater wetland. We use natural wetland processes to remove pollutants. Important note, though, these are artificial or created wetlands and are not, we're not using natural wetlands for stormwater treatment. Oops, slide 87 shows an infiltration trench. In this case, we're taking runoff and we're trying to put it back in the ground. The trench you see is about 4 or 5 feet deep. It's composed of a series of 2-3 inch stone. There's a lot of space in it, so the runoff goes in there, it fills up, and then slowly percolates into groundwater. Slide 88 shows the stormwater filtering system. This is known as bioretention. It's in the wintertime, but you can see the parking lot drains into the parking lot island and is filtered through 2 or 3 feet of sand and compost and soil. And then it's picked up by an underdrain and sent downstream. Our last stormwater practice is shown in slide 89. It's simply using grass swales and similar kinds of treatment to infiltrate runoff as water is moving down the landscape. We talked a little bit about it earlier, but if we move to slide 90, there's quite a bit of evidence that stormwater practices show a moderate, in some cases a high ability to remove pollutants and stormwater runoff. The center has produced a compilation of research studies, I think of almost 125 different research studies on the performance of stormwater management practices. And they do a pretty good job at that. There's also the American Society of Civil Engineers has a larger database now as well. But they weren't really designed to maintain aquatic diversity in streams, so the studies that have been done so far have really not been able to demonstrate that effect that stormwater practices can, for example, maintain fish diversity downstream. Hopefully the next generation of stormwater practices can. Alright, I want to take a break at slide 91.
Would anyone on the telephone like to ask a question?
Erin in Troy, New York.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a question about these impervious surface thresholds. These numbers can be used to actually argue against cluster development if they're applied on the wrong scale. Maybe you could address that.
Yeah, and thank you for raising that whole question. The impervious cover model was one of the most misinterpreted and misused models out there. I often feel bad for having done it because people use it in ways that are pretty odd. And the one that you're talking about is a pretty common case where a community group will use the impervious cover model and say, oh, by going from clustering everything together, we'll get more impervious cover in one area. But the key thing about the impervious cover model is it applies to small watersheds. So the fact that you have a localized density of housing isn't a problem because you reduce impervious cover across the watershed. usually by 30 to 40%. Pretty big numbers.
And Tom, Thomas wants to know, why are wider buffers more important in higher order streams if lower ordered headwater streams are more important targets for protection in the watershed?
Well, I think it's a good question. My sense is that as you get down to third, fourth, and fifth order areas, two things happen that down there that don't happen in your headwater streams. One is the width of your floodplain increases dramatically. So if you have a fourth or fifth order stream, your floodplain might be several hundred feet beyond the banks. So you always want to incorporate your floodplain in the buffer. The second reason for having bigger buffers downstream, in my view, is habitat effects. Third, fourth, fifth order streams tend to have larger, you know, the streams are better habitat and the more species, and so the kind of the habitat imperative. And also, I think when you get to that level, you're getting to the size of having, being part of a greenway or a trail system. So it's, you know, good for park recreation and other uses if possible.
And Anita wants to know, what is your opinion on the effectiveness of grass swales as a BMP for stormwater runoff? And do you, can you suggest any studies in particular on swales?
Yeah, it's a good question. Grass swales or ditches that are not designed specifically for water quality treatment may or may not be effective. But there are several designs of, we call them dry swales or wet swales, that are explicitly designed for stormwater treatment. Those work very effectively. And there's a publication, a couple publications. The Maryland Stormwater Manual has the specifications for dry swales, as does our own book, Design of Stormwater Filtering Systems.
Do we have another question from the telephone audience? And I just want to mention to everyone, we get more questions than every single question is not going to be read or answered, but we do have time for another question from the telephone if you'd like.
I have a question.
Okay.
This is Isabel again. I wondered if there's a way, a good reference or method to project how long the stream is going to downcut and widen, given that it's started already, and if one were to stop development, how long would the process take for it to stabilize?
Yeah, there's some information on that in Manual 4, Urban Stream Repair Practices. There's only been maybe a handful of studies. There's been one in several in the Pacific Northwest indicate the channel enlargement process takes 2 or 3 decades. Back east in our area, we seem to think it's 3 to 5 decades. It's a rough guess once development has reached its maximum.
Thank you.
This is
Ann
at EPA headquarters. Tom, I was under the impression that grass swales were generally a good thing as opposed to your traditional curb and gutters from a stormwater perspective.
Oh, forgive me. Yes, I hate curb and gutters. And compare, you know, swales are a much better alternative to curb and gutter. In fact, that's a key element of better site design, having what we call open section roads, grass swales are preferable to curb and gutters. It's certainly less expensive. And in many cases, they provide, you know, some pollutant removal. All right, are we okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Slide 92 is non-stormwater discharges. And some examples are shown in slide 93. There's a lot of sources of sewage in our watersheds, whether it's cows, illicit discharges, which are shown in the top right-hand panel. In this case, someone had a problem with their failing septic system, so they just put a straight pipe. Other cases, we still have straight pipes that are directly connected to people's toilets and laundry machines. Failing septic systems, about a third of households in America are on septic systems. If they're not maintained, they can fail. And even when they are maintained, they produce high nitrogen levels downstream. Sanitary sewer overflows are pretty common. You see one of those in the right-hand side on the bottom. And the real trick in the watershed plan is to examine the sewage system and figure out ways to reduce those discharges. Our eighth tool is watershed stewardship, and it's a really big category, but what I want to concentrate on today is to think about the behaviors that all of us engage in our own areas that we live that can produce stormwater pollution. When you go to slide 95, it shows a horrible large lot, big mansion subdivision, but it serves our purposes okay. When people at the center look at a neighborhood, we kind of break it into four areas. We have the yard, which is usually the physically largest area. And I just wrote down on the list some of the potential pollution sources in yards. You know, fertilization, pesticides, overwatering, so on and so forth. We have rooftops, and those rooftops can be disconnected. In many cases, though, people are adding to rooftops, and in those rooftops is where they often store household hazardous waste. The driveway is an important neighborhood area where certain behaviors like car washing, leaf blowing, hosing, application of salt during the winter, and fluid changing. And then the common areas, which are part of many newer subdivisions, have issues like maintaining stormwater practices, stream buffers, and pet waste, picking up after our pets. So with that, I think it gets me to the tail end of our presentation today, which is the center's, before we go, let's go to 96. And 96 shows some key differences between two neighborhoods. I think you saw the neighborhood in panel A before. I just thrown up against another neighborhood in panel B. And the point is when we look at watersheds, we break watersheds into neighborhoods. Usually, each neighborhood has distinct factors and distinct behaviors and distinct sources of pollution. So comparing A versus B, we would obviously see that a lot more fertilization occurs in neighborhood A, there's a higher forest cover in neighborhood D. There's clearly differences in all those factors that we saw in the previous slide. But let's start our famous Center for Watershed Protection Stewardship quiz. First question is, in suburban areas, what is the largest crop by area? And the answer, shown in slide 98, is turf grass. In fact, in the Chesapeake Basin, where the center is located, it's the largest crop by area, exceeding corn, wheat, soybeans, and hay. It grows 5 to 10% each decade. And about two-thirds of it is the home lawn. And we're all kind of little farmers, so our behaviors with respect to fertilization, use of pesticides, and lawn irrigation can cumulatively be very significant, even though they're not so, you know, they don't seem so significant just on our own little piece of ground. All right, question number two, of what proportion of homeowners apply fertilizers, and how many of them over-fertilize? The answer, according to surveys, is about 9 out of 10 of us have a yard. About 50% fertilize their yard, and about half who do fertilize over-fertilize with more than 2 applications per year. So clearly, in certain neighborhoods, lawn fertilization is very important. Question number three, how many households own a dog, and what percentage of dog walkers pick up after their pets? The answer is shown in slide 102. It's kind of surprising. About 40% of all households own a dog. If your dog, it's not a great life because only half of you guys walk your dogs. But of those who walk their dog, 60% claim to pick up after them some or all the time, according to a center survey. But, you know, I don't believe it. So let's go to slide 103. Car washing is another potentially negative watershed behavior. So what percentage of homeowners wash their own cars, and how frequently do they do it? Answer on slide 104. 60 to 70% of households wash their own car. I'll have to admit, I'm in the minority. I haven't washed my car in a decade, and it looks like it. About 60% of car washers do it chronically. By that, they do it at least once a month during the non-winter season. And 80% of them report their wash water goes directly to the storm drain. So it can be a pretty significant flow in certain areas, particularly more arid areas. All right, slide 105. We're here at a break. So we can take some questions. I think we still have about 12 minutes left for questions, and take it from there.
Okay, Tom, we've got Mo in Chattanooga who wants to know, what's an average percentage IC index for an ideal subdivision development? And I think they're referring to low-impact development.
The question was, what is an ideal impervious cover?
Yeah, index, percentage.
Well, it really depends on the original zoning category from what it's based. So if you go to the front and you saw that it was zoned for 2-acre lot residential and the average impervious cover for that was, what, 12.1%, you can get that, reduce the impervious cover of that by half using better site design and cluster subdivision. So the idea is whatever your base impervious cover is for that density of housing, you can typically reduce it by 40 or 50% simply through better site design.
Okay. Would anyone on the telephone like to ask a question?
I have a question from headquarters for the EPA. How you discussed different kinds of smart growth was very good in integrating it into watershed planning. However, the one aspect of it that I thought was missing a little bit is using cluster development, but ensuring that cluster development doesn't create situations that we see all too commonly with cul-de-sacs and someone who can't get to their school, for example, that's maybe 150 yards from them, but traveling by sidewalks and or roads is over a mile because of not connecting street systems and grid systems. How do we encourage cluster development to keep habitat and slow down habitat fragmentation, but also maintain an interconnected network so that we don't increase the transportation needs and impacts?
Yeah, it's a real good question, and I would just say real quickly is the Office of Smart Watersheds, the Smart Growth at EPA, has some really good materials on that very topic. Our position at the center is that, you know, it's important to do redevelopment infill and create walkable communities in the highly developed areas. And the solution, in my view, is to reduce environmental requirements to some degree in the more urban areas at the site level so that you can get attractive redevelopment. And then communities should commit at the watershed level to aggressive restoration of those watersheds. So the idea is to relax at the site so that you actually attract redevelopment and make it happen, but have to maintain water quality and restore it, commit to a municipal program of stormwater retrofitting, urban stream repair, reforestation. And we have developed at the center something known as the Smart Watersheds Benchmarking Tool, which really measures how well a municipality is doing in that area. This summer we're testing it in Austin, Texas, Santa Monica, California, and I believe someplace in North Carolina. And once that tool was done, I think it will give us a good yardstick for measuring how well big cities and older cities are doing in the smart growth area.
Tom, we have a question from Stephen. He wants to know, in regards to scale, would you prefer a subwatershed with a 10% impervious cover over the entire extent of a subwatershed, or a 10% of a subwatershed at 100% impervious cover, and why? I know, to give you a map one late in the day.
If a train left Chicago at 3 p.m.
It was traveling
40 miles. That's a real hard question to answer. I would say this much. If the 100% area that was developed was at the bottom of the subwatershed, we would know that the top of the subwatershed was in great shape. So that's probably one situation where the location of imperviousness would make a big difference.
Okay, thank you. We have time for maybe one or two more questions from the telephone.
This is Shora from New York. I have a question related to the impact of impervious cover with Dean Kerman. Earlier in early slides, Tom, you mentioned increased bank pool flooding to be a factor, and I was wondering if you meant to include smaller storms with greater frequency that are considered to be channel-forming events to be included in this, or did you mean a bigger storm such as a 10-year storm?
Right. Excellent question. I really didn't define bank full flooding, but typically bank full flooding are the events that just fill the channel and it doesn't spill out over its banks. So for most areas of the country, that involves storms from about a six-month return frequency up to about a year-and-a-half to two-year storm events. And those are the storms that control the geometry of the stream. Those are the storms that create the channel enlargement that we've talked so much about today. So, yeah, to answer your question, the increased frequency of bank pool flooding is really the causal link to the stream channel enlargement, that we're increasing the frequency or the power that the stream is subject to during the storm event.
Do we have another question from the cell phone?
Tom, this is Mike Schlegel with KCI Technologies in Raleigh. I appreciate you doing this webcast today. Being in this industry, you know that resources are limited and we can't do everything we want. Curious what recommendations you would have on prioritizing either sources of problems or restorations or even subwatersheds to do more detailed studies on.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it starts with, it's not a technical answer. It's a community answer by involving stakeholders and a wide group of people about what the goals are, where to start first, which subwatersheds to go after, what is the key pollutant concern. And often, we're so involved in regulation and the Clean Water Act and TMDLs and other drivers that we don't think to ask the public what they're really most concerned about. In some cases, they're more concerned about having greenways and recreation. So I think the first step to prioritize, prioritization is to ask a wider circle of people what they care about. The more technical answer to your question, I'll just say is in August we'll be putting out a manual called The Methods of Watershed Restoration, and it goes through some very detailed techniques for ranking and prioritizing restoration projects and coming up with goals as a community. So look for that on our website come August.
That might be a good segue, Tom. Obviously, we'd like to really thank Tom Schuller and the Center for Watershed Protection for their participation today. And Tom has graciously included some very good resources in the links to additional resources page. And if you go to your last slide, slide 107, there is a link to the additional resources right there. And it goes to some information from the Center for Watershed Protection. It also goes to the 8 Tools of Watershed Protection in Developing Areas, I think Watershed Academy module that we did in cooperation, Watershed Academy did in cooperation with Tom and some other folks. And I also wanted to mention that we're going to be doing some future webcasts, and we'll be making those available online, making the information about what the schedule is available online through the Watershed Academy and through some listservs and some other resources. I just, by the way, want to let folks know, please fill out your form for recommendations and things we can do, the feedback form. And I realize we had some audio problems today, and we apologize for that, but overall, we'd still like to have comments on the content and the delivery mechanism and the way things went today. And I just thought folks might be interested to know that we had 188 people registered on the phone lines today and 283 registered on the simulcast. And so that's, I'm not the greatest at math, but that's like 450 people, I think. And I'd really like to, like I said, thank Tom for participating and just let folks know that 400-something participants, I think, is an effective use of our resources, even if the telephone transmission was a little rough. Does anyone have any final questions or comments, or is everyone, please fill out your feedback form. You have the resources slide that links to today. And I want to mention also that today's seminar will be archived and made available from this website sometime next week. You'll be able to listen to the entire broadcast again. You can do everything except for ask questions live, but you'll be able to see the questions that were submitted today. You'll be able to see the slides that Tom reviewed, and you'll be able to actually hear the audio stream if you have Windows Media Player or another player available. So I'd like to thank the 471 people who participated today for their participation, and most especially on behalf of the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watershed and the Watershed Academy, thank Tom Schuller for his outstanding job today.